Welcome to the Deep Dive. Now, today, we've got a really specific mission, and it's quite high stakes if you're in a particular spot. If you are an EC3 115 monetary economics student, and we're guessing you might be tuning in for exactly this reason, this entire deep dive is for you. We're aiming to give you the ultimate prep for your exam on classical monetary theory.
Yeah, we're going beyond just the, you know, the basic definitions.
Definitely moving past the flashcards. Our goal today is to really synthesize these foundational concepts. We're talking about the internal consistency challenge from Patinkin, nailing down what neutrality really means, and looking at the quantity theory of money, not just the equation, but it's often a tricky empirical side.
That's exactly right. Look, this isn't about just memorizing terms. It's about getting the deep logical structure of this classical general equilibrium framework. We really need to clearly lay out how the real and monetary sectors are supposed to interact according to the classics. Then pinpoint that specific logical issue Patinkin brought up, and then crucially contrast those, well, elegant theoretical predictions, like that idea of strict proportionality, with the actual data, which frankly can be pretty messy and depends heavily on the economic situation, the regime.
So understanding the connections, the logic, that's the key.
If you can grasp the logical links we're going to cover today, you've basically mastered this core part of the course.
All right, let's dive in. Our mission is to unpack this whole classical system. And I think we have to start with the concept that really defines its whole worldview, the classical dichotomy. Why is this dichotomy so central? And what exactly does it imply for how variables get determined in their model?
The classical dichotomy. Yeah, it's absolutely the conceptual bedrock. It fundamentally asserts this separation, this dividing line between the real side of the economy and the monetary side.
A clean split.
A very clean split, conceptually. And the big implication of this separation is that the variables that, you know, genuinely impact people's well-being, what we call the real variables, these are determined completely independently of whatever's happening with the money supply.
Okay, so just to be clear, when we say real variables, we mean things like actual output, right? Real GDP, so the real interest rate, $4.
Yeah.
How many people are employed, teller. And the real wage, like the purchasing power of wages, tellyballers.
Exactly. Those are the ones. And the theory says these are driven purely by physical factors and preferences. Things like the available technology, the amount of capital stock, natural resources, people's preferences for work versus leisure. These real factors are exclusively what determine those real outcomes.
So the economy figures out its physical equilibrium first, almost like a barter system in principle.
That's a good way to think about it initially, yes. The system first solves for its physical or real equilibrium. The implication here is quite profound. Money, in this view, is just a veil drawn over the real workings of the economy.
A veil.
Yeah.
Meaning it doesn't really change anything fundamental.
Correct. It can't influence relative prices, like how many apples trade for an orange. It can't affect productivity or the actual level of employment in the long run.
Okay. If money's just this veil, what's its actual job within this classical general equilibrium setup? What does it do?
Its sole non-neutral role is basically to set the scale factor for all nominal prices. So it determines the absolute price level, P, you know, the overall index of prices. And consequently, because the real wage, WP, is already set, it also determines the nominal wage, W.
Ah, right. So once the labor market figures out the real wage needed for equilibrium.
Exactly. Once WT is set by the real forces of labor supply and demand, then the quantity of money floating around determines the specific nominal price level P, and therefore the nominal wage W, that satisfies that real wage ratio.
Let's try and visualize this static model, because getting the structure right is probably key for the exam. The whole system needs to determine five key endogenous variables, right? We've got Y, R, N, P, and dollars.
Right.
How does the sequence of determination enforce that dichotomy we just talked about?
Okay. Yeah, the sequence is crucial for understanding the logic. We can conceptually break down the solution process into two really distinct stages. Stage one, the real sector.
Right.
Here you use standard microeconomic principles. You look at labor, supply, and demand to get employment, all are in the real wage, dollars, dollars. You look at the loanable funds, market saving, and investment, which gives you the real interest rate, dollars. And production functions link inputs like labor to output house. So this real sector determines all the real outcomes first, hour and dollars out.
So the markets for actual goods and for labor, they establish all the relative prices and the real flows of the economy, setting dollars in the process.
Precisely. It's like the real economy gets solved entirely on its own terms first.
Seems conceptually neat, almost like a barter system finding its feet before money even enters the picture.
In essence, yes. It is only then, after all the real variables are determined, that the monetary sector comes into play. Stage two.
Okay.
We bring in the demand for real money balances. This is often written as that familiar equation, MP equals LYRR. Now think about it. Yai and order have already been determined by the real sector in stage one.
Right. They're fixed inputs now for this money equation.
Exactly. So lire and dollars are known values. The money supply is assumed to be set exogenously by the monetary authority, like the central bank. So aller is given, yell is given, star is given. The only unknown left in that equation is absolute price level.
So the equation just solves for P.
It uniquely solves for P. And once you know P, getting the nominal wage is trivial. You just use the real wage dollars that was already determined back in stage one. You know P now, so you immediately know W.
And that structure, that sequence, guarantees the dichotomy works how?
Because if the central bank changes the money supply dollar, look what happens. Yell and Zdaa don't change. They were fixed by real factors. So the only thing that can adjust in the MPLYRR equation is P. If M doubles, P must double proportionally to keep the equation in balance.
Oh, okay.
And if P doubles, then W must also double to keep the real wage WP constant. So a change in M leads to proportional changes in P and W, but leaves all the real variables, Yay, R, and N, completely untouched. That is the classical dichotomy in action within the model structure.
That system. It certainly has a beautiful simplicity to it, that clean separation. But historically, this is exactly where the intellectual debates really started heating up, isn't it? The moment you try to properly integrate money into a general equilibrium framework, you run into these potential consistency issues. And Walras' Law is key to seeing that.
Precisely. Yeah. Walras' Law is the essential analytical tool we use to probe the consistency of this whole classical setup. Remember what Walras' Law fundamentally states? In any economy with, say, non-dollar markets, the sum total of the value of excess demands across all N markets must identically be equal to zero.
Always zero. Why?
Because fundamentally, every transaction involves a two-sided exchange of equal value. Every sale implies a purchase. You can't demand something without supplying something of equal value in return, even if that something is just, well, money or a claim. So in aggregate, total demand value must equal total supply value. Therefore, total excess demand value must be zero. It's an accounting identity, really.
Okay, but now in a monetary economy, money itself is one of those non-dollar markets. It's like the nth good, the medium of exchange.
Correct, and that's the crucial step. When we include money as the nth good, Walras' Law still holds true as an identity. The sum of excess demands across all markets, including the money market, is zero. Now we can do a simple algebraic rearrangement.
Go.
We can separate the money market from the others, the identity says. Sum of value of excess demands for goods 1 to N1 plus value of excess demand for money, good N, equals 0. Rearranging gives us value of excess demand for money, sum of value of excess demands for goods 1 to N1.
Okay, so the excess demand for money equals the negative of the excess demand for all the real goods and services.
Which is equivalent to saying the value of the excess demand for money must be identically equal to the value of the excess supply of all the real goods and services combined.
Wow, okay. That single rearrangement value of money, excess demand, equals value of real goods, excess supply. That seems really critical.
Yeah.
Because doesn't that immediately put a constraint on Say's Law?
It absolutely does. And this is a really common point of confusion, so it's worth getting straight for your exam. Say's Law, you know, the basic idea that supply creates its own demand is often interpreted as meaning general gluts or economy-wide overproduction are impossible. In a simple non-monetary barter economy, you could argue that holds almost as an identity. The act of supplying something is simultaneously an act of demanding something else of equal value. But in a monetary economy, Walras' Law throws a wrench in that simple identity.
How so?
Because Walras' Law, as we just showed, tells us that the real sector of the economy, all the goods markets, can only be in equilibrium, meaning the aggregate excess supply of goods is zero if, and only if, the monetary side of the economy is also in equilibrium, meaning the excess demand for money is zero.
Oh, okay, so they're linked. The real side can't clear unless the money market also clears.
Exactly. Which means Say's Law stops being this ironclad identity, something that's just true by the very definition of exchange. Instead, it becomes an inequality, or maybe better put, a condition that is only met when the economy reaches full general equilibrium.
So it's not automatic anymore.
That's the crucial distinction you need to grasp. Say's Law holds as an equality in a monetary economy, meaning it's true only at the specific set of equilibrium relative prices and the specific absolute price level P that clears all markets simultaneously, including the money market. It's not some inevitable identity that emerges just from the process of treating itself.
And that necessity for the money market to clear, that introduces a potential point of failure, a source of disequilibrium for the whole system.
Precisely. And it's this very dependency, this linkage forced by Walras's Law that Don Patinkin famously seized upon in the 1950s.
Right. Here's where Patinkin steps in and basically demonstrates that the classical system, as it had been formalized up to that point, actually contained a really deep internal logical inconsistency. What was the central conflict he identified between those two sectors, the real and the monetary, that we just laid out?
The inconsistency boils down to a violation of something called homogeneity, specifically concerning how the absolute price level, P, behaves in the model. Let's just revisit the assumptions of the two parts of the system again and see exactly where they clash, using Walras's Law as the bridge.
Okay, let's start again with the real sector, the demand and supply functions for actual goods, for labor.
Right. The core classical assumption there is that these real excess demand functions, how much more goods people want than are supplied, or vice versa, depend only on relative prices.
Only relative prices.
Yes. If the nominal price of apples doubles, and the nominal price of oranges also doubles, the relative price, how many oranges per apple, hasn't changed. Therefore, according to classical theory, the real quantity of apples demanded shouldn't change either. People respond to relative costs and benefits, not the absolute price level.
So this implies that the absolute price level, P, is effectively indeterminate within the real sector equations. It just doesn't feature. Only ratios matter.
Exactly. The real sector determines all the relative prices, the real wage, real output, but it simply cannot pin down the overall price level, P.
Okay. Now turn to the monetary sector. This is where P gets determined, right? Through the quantity theory or the money demand function?
Correct. And here's the rub. The demand for money, and therefore the excess demand for money, is fundamentally conceived as a demand for real balances, MPSS. If the nominal money supply, M, is faced by the authorities, then the demand for and the excess demand for money is inherently and unavoidably dependent upon the absolute price level, P. If P changes, MP changes, and money demand changes.
Yeah. And that's the contradiction, isn't it? The real sector says P doesn't matter for demands, but the monetary sector says P absolutely does matter for the demand for the nth good, money itself.
Yes, you've got it. Now, bring Walras's Law back in. Walras's Law insists that the value of the excess demand for money must identically equal the value of the excess supply of real goods.
Right.
But wait, if the real side's excess demand functions depend only on relative prices, meaning they are homogeneous of degree zero in all nominal prices, then the thing they're equal to, the excess demand for money, must also logically depend only on relative prices. It must also be homogeneous of degree zero.
What we just said.
We just established that the excess demand for money explicitly depends on the absolute price level P through the real balance term MP. It is not homogeneous of degree zero in prices alone.
So the system demands two contradictory things from the money demand function simultaneously. It needs to be independent of P to match the real sector structure via Walras's Law, but it also must depend on P in order to actually determine the price level in the first place.
That's the logical bind. This is what Patinkin called the non-homogeneity problem. When you construct the overall excess demand function for the entire system, goods plus money, it turns out not to be homogeneous of degree zero in the absolute price level P and the nominal money stock M together, as a consistent general equilibrium model requires.
What does that mean practically, if it's not homogeneous?
It means if you, say, doubled the money stock M and doubled all nominal prices P, including the nominal wage W, the real sector should theoretically be completely unchanged. Relative prices and real wages are the same. So excess demands in the real sector should remain zero if they were zero before.
Okay.
But because the money demand function wasn't properly specified to respect this homogeneity, doubling P does affect the money market in a way that, via Walras's Law, creates an unintended non-zero excess demand somewhere in the system, even though all relative prices are unchanged. This is a fundamental contradiction of the general equilibrium concept. It proves the classical dichotomy, as originally formulated without considering this link, is logically unsound. It just doesn't hang together consistently.
Wow, okay. That is a really deep flaw exposing the very foundation of the theory.
Mm-hmm.
So how does Patinkin's fix the real balance effect, the RBE? How does that actually step in to repair the structural inconsistency? What's the mechanism that restores the required homogeneity?
The real balance effect provides the crucial, the missing link. It connects the absolute price level, P, back to the real side of the economy, specifically through wealth effects on spending.
Wealth effects. How does that work?
Think about what happens if the system is temporarily out of equilibrium. Say there's an excess supply of goods, a recessionary gap, maybe. In a classical world with price flexibility, the overall price level P should start to fall.
Okay. And under the flawed dichotomy, a fall in P shouldn't really affect the real demand for goods at all, right? Because only relative prices matter there.
Exactly. Under the original inconsistent formulation, falling prices wouldn't necessarily help restore equilibrium on the real side. But Penkin said, wait a minute, it must affect real demand. Here's how. When P falls, and assuming the nominal money stock M is held constant,
the real value of money balances, M divided by P, actually increases.
Precisely. MP goes up. Now, Patinkin argued that these real money balances constitute a form of net wealth for the private sector, especially if we think about outside money, money issued by the government that isn't offset by private debt. An increase in MP makes people holding that money feel wealthier in real terms.
Right, their money buys more stuff now. So the RBE basically says this increased perceived wealth actually stimulates their spending.
That's the core idea. It acts like a positive wealth effect in the aggregate consumption function. Consumers, feeling a bit richer because their real balances have increased, decide to increase their demand for real goods and services.
Ah, I see. So the fall in P does affect real demand, just indirectly through this wealth channel operating via MP.
Exactly. This increase in aggregate demand, triggered by the falling price level via the RBE, helps to absorb the initial excess supply of goods. It pushes the economy back towards its full employment equilibrium. The real balance effect, therefore, becomes this crucial automatic adjustment mechanism. It guarantees, theoretically at least, the existence and stability of a full employment equilibrium even when the absolute price level changes, because those changes feed back into real spending decisions.
Okay, so by ensuring that a change in the absolute price level P, through its effect on MP, does create a change in the real excess demand functions via wealth effects on spending, the system is now forced to satisfy that homogeneity condition we talked about.
That's how homogeneity is restored. Let's rerun that thought experiment. Double M and double P. Now, MP is unchanged. Because MP is unchanged, there's no real balance effect on wealth, and therefore no change in real aggregate demand originating from the monetary side. The real sector is unaffected, relative prices are constant, and the monetary side, via RBE, introduces no new disturbance. The system remains consistent.
So the RBE essentially validates the classical conclusion that price flexibility can restore full employment, but it does so by admitting that money isn't entirely a neutral veil during the adjustment process. It has to have this temporary real effect via wealth to make the whole system logically coherent.
Beautifully put. It ensures the market for goods and the market for money are intrinsically linked by a real variable, those real money balances, MP acting through wealth. It makes the dichotomy work, but subtly changes its nature by requiring this real effect channel.
That is a fantastic clarification of why Patinkin's work was so critical. Okay, let's shift gears now. We've repaired the internal logic. Let's talk about the main long-run prediction that Patinkin was, in a sense, trying to save, the concept of the neutrality of money. What exactly does neutrality mean in this context?
Right. Neutrality of money is really the core long-run policy implication of the whole classical system. Defined strictly, it means that changes in the level of the nominal money supply, or perhaps more relevantly, permanent changes in the rate of growth of the money supply, will ultimately only affect nominal variables.
Nominal variables like?
Like the price level P, the rate of inflation, nominal GDP, nominal wages. But, and this is the crucial part, they have no permanent effect on real variables.
So no lasting impact on things like long-run real output, potential GDP, the real interest rate, or the natural rate of unemployment.
Exactly. Those real variables are still determined by the real factors, technology, resources, preferences in the long run. Money just scales the nominal values up or down.
This concept seems absolutely fundamental for distinguishing between what monetary policy can and cannot achieve, right? It implies that if a central bank just keeps printing money, trying to permanently boost real growth,
they will ultimately only succeed in generating inflation. That's the classical takeaway, yeah. And it's a remarkably persistent idea. It holds strong even when you look at more modern microeconomic models.
Really? Even things like new Keynesian models with sticky prices?
Yes. Think about those models that explicitly build in frictions, like staggered price setting or multi-period wage contracts. Those models absolutely show that money is non-neutral in the short run. A surprise monetary policy change, an unexpected injection of money, can cause quite persistent real effects on output, on employment, maybe even on the real interest rate for a while as prices adjust slowly.
Okay, so short-run effects are possible, even likely.
Yes, but the key distinction is long-run neutrality. When you extend the time horizon in these models, when all prices have had time to fully adjust, when all contracts can be renegotiated, when agents have fully incorporated the change in monetary policy into their expectations, then the systematic, predictable component of monetary policy becomes ineffective again in influencing real variables. Money is still predicted to be neutral in the long run.
So the broad consensus seems to be short run can be messy, non-neutral effects are possible, but the long run destination is still basically classical neutrality. How robust is that long run prediction when we look at actual economic data?
Generally speaking, it's pretty robust, particularly if you look at stable, developed economies with relatively low and stable inflation. If you take long periods of data, say 30 years or more, for places like the US or the G7 countries as a group, the evidence largely confirms long-run neutrality.
Meaning you don't see a lasting statistical link where, say, faster money growth over decades leads to permanently faster real output growth.
Exactly. You just don't find that sustained positive correlation. In fact, if anything, when you start looking at regimes with very high and unstable money growth, like chronic high inflation or hyperinflation,
the relationship might even reverse.
It often does. High and unpredictable money growth in those situations is frequently associated with reduced real output growth, likely due to increased uncertainty, resource misallocation, trying to cope with inflation, and damage to the financial system. So the empirical evidence broadly supports long-run neutrality and even suggests non-neutrality and high inflation might be negative for real outcomes.
Okay, that takes us perfectly into the mechanism itself. If money affects prices proportionally in the long run, that points directly to the quantity theory of money, the QTM. Let's really nail down its definition and its core prediction, starting with the equation of exchange.
Right, the QTM originates from what is, at its core, an accounting identity, the equation of exchange. It's most often used these days in its income form, which is $1 VAS ABV equal PHOY.
Okay, let's break that down. M is the nominal money stock.
Correct. V is the income velocity of circulation, basically. The average number of times a unit of money, like a dollar or a euro, is used to finance transactions that make up nominal income during a specific period, say, a year.
Got it. P is the aggregate price level, like the GDP deflator. And EI is?
Yawlers is real income or real output. Sometimes in older formulations, you see T for the volume of transactions, but using real income yawlers is more common now and links it directly to national accounts. So P na ya is just nominal income or nominal GDP.
Okay, so one novel, V, C yat, V, I to L. Money stock times how fast it turns over equals the total nominal value of output. That makes sense as an identity. It has to be true by definition, like saying total spending equals total receipts.
Exactly. It's just an identity that relates these four variables. The theory, the QTM, comes from the behavioral assumptions we impose on some of those variables, specifically V and Y.
Right. What are the key assumptions that turn the identity into a predictive theory?
The central prediction of the traditional QTM is one of strict proportionality. It posits that a given percentage change in the nominal money stock, M, will translate in equilibrium into an exactly equal percentage change in the overall price level, P.
So double M, you double P, 10% increase in M, 10% increase in P.
That's the core prediction. And it's predicated on two crucial assumptions. First, that velocity, V, is effectively fixed, or at least highly stable and predictable, determined by institutional factors that don't change quickly.
Assumption one.
Second, that real output, Y, is fixed at its full employment or potential level, determined entirely by the real factors, technology, capital, labor supply that we discussed under the classical dichotomy. So U is also treated as independent of M in the long run.
Assumption two, fix U. So if V and U are constant in the equation way, then any change in M must be matched by a proportional change in P to maintain the equality.
Precisely. That's the logic that delivers the strict proportionality prediction.
Now, this reliance on a fixed V and a fixed U often leads to the QTM being criticized, maybe characterized as a bit, well, crude or overly simplistic as an economic model. Was the original formulation, say by economists like Irving Fisher, who was central to this, genuinely that rigid? Did they really think V and Yen never changed?
That's a common misconception, I think. Calling it crude is often based on a simplified textbook version used mainly to isolate that proportionality result clearly. Fisher, for instance, was far more nuanced.
Oh yeah, how so?
He absolutely understood that V and T, or Y, were not just arbitrary constants pulled out of thin air. He saw them as being determined by what he termed deep parameters, fundamental aspects of the economy's structure, institutions, and individual behavior.
Okay, so what sort of things determine the volume of trade, T or Y, in Fisher's view?
He listed quite a few factors, all very much on the real side. Conditions affecting producers and consumers, like technology, tastes, the efficiency of transportation infrastructure, the degree of freedom of trade, tariffs, regulations, general monetary and banking conditions affecting credit, and overall business confidence. These are all things that constrain the real capacity of the economy.
Right. Those sound like the determinants of potential output we'd think of today.
Yeah.
And what about velocity, V? What determined its stability or level?
For velocity, Fisher pointed to things like individual habits, how people manage their cash flow, how often they get paid versus how often they make purchases. Second, the institutional efficiency of the payment system itself, how quickly checks clear, the availability of credit, the speed of bank transfers.
So technological and institutional factors in payments.
Exactly. And also broader social conditions that might influence people's desire to hold liquid assets, their preference for cash versus other forms of wealth. The key point is that Fisher saw these determinants of VNT as being largely slow-moving structural factors.
So while the QTM relies on VNT being stable relative to changes in M for the proportionality prediction to hold in the short to medium run, it didn't assume they were immutable constants forever.
Correct. It acknowledges that deep non-monetary forces determine their actual levels, but assumes these forces change slowly enough that for analyzing the impact of, say, a change in M, you can often treat V and Y as approximately fixed in the relevant time frame.
Okay, that adds important nuance. But now let's introduce dynamics, specifically inflationary expectations. How does a situation where everyone expects inflation, say, because a central bank announces a policy of sustained monetary expansion, maybe M will grow at 10% per year indefinitely. How does that challenge the simple proportionality prediction? Does it affect those deep parameters, especially velocity V?
Yes. This is where the theory gets more sophisticated and moves beyond the purely static model. And it absolutely challenges simple proportionality by directly impacting velocity.
How?
The static QTM would just say, okay, 10% money growth leads to 10% inflation, assuming V and U are constant. End of story. But once economic agents firms internalize that expectation of ongoing 10% inflation, their behavior must change. Why? Because inflation imposes an opportunity cost on holding money.
Right. Money typically doesn't earn interest, or not much anyway. So if prices are rising by 10%, holding cash means losing 10% of your purchasing power each year. We need to bring in the Fisher equation here, don't we?
Exactly. The Fisher equation connects nominal interest rates, R, real interest rates, and expected inflation. Roughly $1 is R plus pi. Now, if the long-run real rate to dollars is anchored by real productivity factors, say it's stable at 3%, and everyone suddenly expects inflation pi to be 10% persistently,
then the nominal interest rate R must jump up to incorporate that inflation premium. It'll rise from maybe 3% to 13%.
Correct. And that significant jump in the nominal interest rate R represents a much higher opportunity cost of holding non-interest-bearing money compared to holding interest-bearing assets, like bonds.
So people will want to hold less cash, less money in their checking accounts because it's more costly to do so now.
Precisely. Agents will actively seek to economize on their holdings of real money balances, MP. The demand for MP falls because the opportunity cost, R, has risen. Now, at the moment this expectation shifts, the actual supply of real balances MP hasn't changed yet. So you have a situation where the demand for real money is suddenly lower than the existing supply. The money market is out of equilibrium.
And the market needs to clear. How does it do that? The nominal money stock, M, can't just instantly adjust downwards.
No, M is typically controlled, or at least heavily influenced, by the central bank and adjusts more slowly. So if M is relatively fixed in the very short term and the demand for MP is dropped, the only way for the market to clear to reduce the actual supply of MP down to the new lower desired level is for the price level P to jump upwards.
Ah, a discrete immediate jump in P.
Exactly. This requires a once-for-all increase in the price level P, which happens in addition to the ongoing 10% inflation trend that will result from the 10% money growth. This initial sharp jump in P serves purely to reduce the real value of the existing money stock, MP, to match the new lower level of demand.
And that initial jump in P, holding M constant for that instant.
Yeah.
mathematically, what does that imply about velocity v in the equation 1v equals yy?
If m is constant, y is constant, and p jumps up, then v must also jump up proportionally. This whole mechanism, expectations change, nominal rates rise, demand for real balances falls, price level jumps up, is exactly equivalent to a sudden sharp increase in the velocity of money, v.
So velocity is no longer constant. It structurally adjusts upwards to a new permanently higher level because of the change in inflationary expectations and the resulting change in behavior regarding money holding.
That's the critical insight. The economy eventually settles into a new equilibrium path where M and P are both growing steadily at 10% per year, maintaining long-run neutrality and growth rates. But the level of the price path P is permanently higher than it would have been without that initial jump. And that jump corresponds to velocity having shifted to a higher plateau.
This really highlights how velocity isn't just some fixed institutional parameter, but is intrinsically linked to the public's confidence, their expectations about future monetary policy, and the resulting opportunity cost of holding money. Which brings us squarely to the empirical validation. If velocity is theoretically unstable, especially when expectations shift, how well does that core QTM prediction of strict proportionality actually hold up when we look at real-world data?
Empirically. Well, the relationship is complex. That core prediction of strict one-for-one proportionality between money growth and inflation is, frankly, often not maintained in the data.
Yeah.
The reason seems to be that the relationship is highly nonlinear and very dependent on the context, specifically the prevailing economic regime.
Okay, regime dependent. Let's break that down. What does the evidence show in, say, low inflation environments? Like the modern developed economies we discussed earlier, the US, Europe, Japan, over the last few decades.
Right. In these relatively stable, low inflation, low money growth regimes, the empirical evidence, for example, from studies like those by Paul DeGraw, tends to show that the QTM prediction is significantly weakened, sometimes almost non-existent in the short to medium term.
Weakened how?
If you run regressions of inflation on money growth for these countries over recent decades, the coefficient on money growth is often very low, sometimes statistically insignificant, and certainly well below the value of one predicted by strict proportionality.
Why would that be, if the theory holds in the long run?
Because in these stable environments, many other factors seem to dominate the short to medium term fluctuations in inflation. Things like real shocks, oil price changes, productivity shifts, supply chain disruptions, changes in indirect taxes, inertia in wage setting processes. These factors create a lot of noise and variation in inflation that effectively swamps or obscures the potentially weaker, longer-term signal coming from moderate changes in money growth.
So in that regime, money growth and inflation can appear almost unrelated or very weakly related.
Yes, and in some studies for low inflation countries, money growth and output growth also appear largely independent, which further reinforces the non-proportionality result for prices, since the simple QTM assumes U is fixed relative to M.
Okay, so if I'm, say, running a central bank in a country with stable 2% inflation, relying solely on targeting money supply growth to control that inflation might be a pretty poor strategy because the link is just too unreliable in the short to medium term.
It's generally considered ineffective or at least very difficult in that kind of environment, yes. The relationship isn't stable enough for fine-tuning. However, the entire situation dramatically reverses when we shift our attention to unstable, high inflation, or outright hyperinflationary environments.
Ah, okay. So this is where the QTM suddenly becomes, perhaps, frighteningly relevant again. But you said nonlinear. Does it become proportional now or something else?
It becomes more than proportional. This is the fascinating part. For countries experiencing high and accelerating inflation, the empirical evidence flips completely. Studies consistently find that money growth has a more than proportional effect on inflation.
More than proportional, meaning the coefficient relating inflation to money growth is significantly greater than one.
Exactly. If the money supply grows by, say, 100% in a year during hyperinflation, prices might increase by 150% or 200% or even more. This is the very essence of hyperinflation dynamics, famously analyzed by Philip Kagan back in the 1950s.
And what's the mechanism driving this explosive more than proportional effect? Is it back to velocity and expectations?
It is entirely driven by that feedback loop involving expectations and the resulting flight from money that we touched on earlier. As agents see prices rising rapidly and expect inflation to accelerate even further, their incentive to hold the rapidly depreciating domestic currency plummets.
They want to get rid of it as fast as possible.
Instantly. They try to dump the currency for real goods, services, stable foreign assets, anything that might hold its value better. This desperate attempt to spend money the moment it's received causes the velocity of circulation, V, to accelerate dramatically. V starts rising much, much faster than the rate at which the government is actually printing new money in.
So V itself becomes endogenous and highly unstable.
Highly unstable and self-reinforcing. Rising inflation causes velocity to rise, which via MV pi way causes inflation to rise even faster, which further damages confidence and pushes velocity higher still. It's a vicious cycle. This hypervelocity is what ensures that prices end up rising much faster, more than proportionally, compared to the increase in the nominal money stock.
And we saw historical examples of this, like the German hyperinflation.
Classic example. Real money balances, MP, absolutely collapsed during that period, eventually falling to maybe only 3% or so of their pre-crisis levels. That catastrophic drop in the demand for real money, driven by collapsing confidence and skyrocketing velocity, is what forced the price level piece skyward at a rate far exceeding the already rapid rate of money creation.
Okay, so that distinction is absolutely critical for understanding the QPM empirically. In stable, low inflation regimes, the relationship between M and P is often too weak or noisy to confirm strict proportionality. But in high inflation or hyperinflationary regimes, the relationship becomes incredibly strong, but it's more than proportional, precisely because the underlying assumption of stable velocity completely breaks down in a spectacular nonlinear way driven by expectations.
You've nailed it. The takeaway for your studies has to be that while the QTM provides the fundamental long-run link between money and prices, its specific prediction of proportionality is highly fragile. It depends entirely on the stability of expectations and the resulting behavior of velocity. Once expectations become unanchored and velocity takes off, proportionality is lost and the dynamics become explosive.
This brings us very neatly to a powerful synthesis, I think. We started by laying out the elegant structure of the classical system, which gave us that crucial long-run concept. The neutrality of money.
Right. And then we discovered that this initially appealing system wasn't actually internally consistent or logically sound on its own terms. It required the crucial intervention of Patinkin and his real balance effect.
Yeah, the RBE was needed to ensure that the absolute price level could influence real demand, at least during the adjustment phase, plugging the logical hole in the classical dichotomy and restoring the necessary homogeneity to make the model work.
Precisely. And then finally, we examine the central mechanism within that classical framework, the quantity theory of money. And we found that while it provides the basic story, its core prediction of proportionality is highly contextual.
Right. It seems to fail empirically in stable, low inflation contexts because the link between M and P gets drowned out by other factors, making V appear unstable relative to M and P.
And it becomes explosively non-proportional in the other direction during high inflation episodes, precisely because V becomes dramatically unstable, driven entirely by that collapse in public faith and the resulting flight from money.
So the empirical truth of this classical monetary theory seems heavily dependent on the economic regime, the stability of the environment.
It really is. The difference between finding a weak, insignificant coefficient relating money to inflation in the G7 countries versus finding a coefficient much larger than one during a hyperinflation lies almost entirely in those behavioral dynamics surrounding velocity and confidence. And that leads us directly to our final provocative thought, something for you to really chew on as you continue your studies. We've firmly established this idea that money is neutral in the long run. That's a cornerstone. But what's truly fascinating and perhaps unsettling is just how incredibly unstable that relationship between money and prices becomes during periods of high inflation and collapsing confidence. Mm. It raises a fundamental question, I think. If the very value and stability of money are ultimately underpinned by public expectations and confidence, as dramatically demonstrated by those massive non-proportional velocity shifts during hyperinflations, can any purely mechanical quantity-based monetary rule ever be truly robust or stable in the face of a genuine crisis of faith in the currency or the authority issuing it? If confidence collapses, does the whole classical framework, which relies on relatively stable behavior and expectations, effectively break down? Does it force us inevitably into policy regimes where credibility, trust, and managing expectations become far more important than simply controlling the quantity of money itself?
That's a fantastic challenge to the limits of the purely classical model, and it sets up so much of modern monetary policy debate about credibility, anchors and the choice between rules versus discretion, a perfect intellectual foundation to build on. We really hope this deep dive into the theoretical consistency, the core predictions, and the complex empirical reality of classical monetary theory has armed you well. Good luck with that EC3 115 exam preparation.